This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
Welcome to the briefing room with me, David Aronovich. In this podcast, you open the auditory door, come in and find out what's going on in the world. And please let us know what you think by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. If you're minded to do so, please recommend us to anyone you can think of, really. Also, if you enjoy this podcast, you might enjoy other editions of The Briefing Room, from Trump to China to the world of AI. This week, I'm getting briefed on the radical changes being made by Saudi Arabia's young and charismatic new crown prince. Enjoy. Imagine waking up on a Sunday morning to the news that dozens of the highest profile people in the country, including ministers, billionaire business leaders, and even members of the royal family, have been arrested and locked up in a luxury hotel. It's like a movie. And it happened in Saudi Arabia earlier this month. The purge was ostensibly part of an anti-corruption drive by the country's new crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman. And the young prince is shaking things up in other ways too. In September, it was announced that from next year, women would be allowed to drive.
Driving is a symbol of change in Saudi Arabia. Driving for us is an act to consider us full citizens in our country.
It was a big surprise, and just one part of a push for more social freedom in the kingdom, a place where the religious police, known as the Committee for the Promotion of Virtue and the Prevention of Vice, patrol the streets. As if that wasn't enough, MBS, as he's known, also wants to radically reshape the country's oil-dependent economy, a country deeply involved in a bloody struggle in neighbouring Yemen. So what is Mohammed bin Salman really up to? And will his plans work?
He will either be the saviour of that country who brings it back into the 21st century, or he will be the man with the blowtorch who melts the glue that holds that country together.
Step into the briefing room to find out which is most likely. First into the briefing room to tell me more about Saudi history and Mohammed bin Salman's place in it is the Middle East correspondent of The Economist, Nicholas Pelham, who has met and interviewed the reforming crown prince.
I think you have to understand that 1979 was this seminal year in which so much of the trajectory of the Middle East was turned on its head. In Iran, you had a religious revolution against the Shah, led by Shia Ayatollahs. I think the Saudis at that point became very nervous that just as the monarch in Iran had been overthrown, so you could see a religious revolution against their own authority. And indeed, it almost appeared to happen in Mecca when some Wahhabi clerics descended on Mecca, took control of Mecca, and seized the religious authority which had underpinned the Al Saud dynasty until that point. And it looked as if a religious revolution was going to take place in Saudi Arabia At the same time, in Egypt, you had peace treaty between Egypt and Israel, who had, the previous 30 years had been at war. And it really seemed as if the whole of the Middle East was changing and could sweep the Al Sauds aside with it. And in order to prevent that, they established a new compact with the religious establishment, which gave the clerical establishment control over public space. I think the kingdom is in many ways moving in two directions under Mohammed bin Salman. In some ways, it's going back to a past which was very much like other parts of the Middle East. It was remarkably pluralist. It encompassed many different religious and ethnic communities. It was as much a patchwork as many other parts of the Middle East. For the last 70 years or even a century, the Arabian Peninsula has been under the thumb of an obscurantist, dogmatic clergy that controlled public space. And under Mohammed bin Salman, they have been consistently pushed back. They've lost their powers of arrest. Those members of the religious establishment who have dared even mildly criticise the direction of travel under Mohammed bin Salman have risked arrest, and some are still in detention. So you're seeing a kingdom which was ruled by a dynasty, the Al Sauds, in conjunction with a religious establishment that was given total control of public space, provided it didn't really threaten the prerogatives of the ruling family. And that alliance is breaking down, and the religious authorities no longer command the same degree of control. We were summoned by one of Mohammed bin Salman's advisors for an interview. We were then ushered into a living room with a large television. There were swords hanging on the walls, and slumped on a diwan was Mohammed bin Salman himself, watching the latest headlines that he'd helped create by executing 47 Saudis in what was the largest execution the kingdom had seen for over three decades. He was remarkably confident. He had any number of facts and figures on his fingertips. The meeting started perhaps at about 8:30. It finished pretty much near 3 o'clock in the morning. He was focused the whole time, leading the discussion. And the impression that he gave was one in which he wanted to really overhaul the kingdom and lift it out of its sort of medieval obscurantism and transform it into a modern kingdom, open to the world, but by no means democratic, sort of very much under his thumb.
Our ambition. It starts with over 26,000 square kilometers of land, set in an ideal location where three continents meet, right at the heart.
You're seeing Mohammed bin Salman present what he calls Vision 2030, which by 2030 will have turned an economy round from one in which people get very generous allowances into one in which they have to contribute, in which they have to pay tax, in which they have to participate, in which women as well as men have to participate in the workplace.
We see a place that will inspire new learning, create new industries, and encourage enterprise, invention, and ingenuity. A hive of creativity.
Observers have been warning for years that Saudi Arabia can no longer rely on high oil prices. It can no longer rely on a single resource to sustain the largesse with which it treats its population. What Mohammed bin Salman has been trying to do is to diversify the economy, and he also wants to wean the population off their dependence. At the moment, up to about 80% of the population work in the public sector. The private sector can't really compete with anything like the perks and allowances that the public sector provides, and so it's largely depended on migrant labour to sustain itself. Part of that tension between the ideal of Saudi Arabia and the reality has also been in the lifestyles that many people are living. They see alternative ways of life. There's probably nowhere in the Middle East which spends as much time online as the population of Saudi Arabia. They're in tune with trends elsewhere in the world. They see how other people having fun in a kingdom which somehow has considered fun to be sinful. And many have already been pushing at the edges. The segregation of the past is rapidly breaking down in the kingdom.
A royal decree has been issued in Saudi Arabia giving women the right to drive. This is a historic day for Saudi society, for men and women, and we can now say at last.
But you're really seeing a female population which had been pushed into purdah under this sort of clerical rule that dates back at least to 1979 suddenly fill public space again. And I think for many people in Saudi Arabia, while they welcome the change, the pace of change is deeply disorientating. For many years, Saudi Arabia has felt a little bit like the last decades of the Soviet Union, in that it's been led by these elderly men who have seemed out of touch with an increasingly young and vibrant population. And what you've had with Mohammed bin Salman is a young, charismatic leader who has no fear of appearing in the public domain. When he took office as Minister of Defence and de facto leader, he was aged 29, 30. That already puts him over the average in Saudi Arabia. The majority of the population is under 30. But for the first time, many young people in the kingdom see a leader that they can relate to, that is of their age and shares their aspirations. And I think it's been remarkable the extent to which he's managed as well to forge a relationship with a new younger generation coming out of the White House.
Nicholas Pelham from The Economist on the man who sounds like he could be the Mikhail Gorbachev of Saudi Arabia. In a moment, we'll discuss Mohammed bin Salman's motives and whether his plans will work with a panel of experts on Saudi Arabia. But first, I want to know what the relatively very youthful population in Saudi Arabia think of him. As Nicholas mentioned, they're very active on social media, so I've invited Mohammed El Assar from the BBC's monitoring team, which tracks mass media, to the briefing room. He joins us from Jerusalem.
Saudi Arabia is especially keen on certain social media platforms. So, for example, Twitter, one in every three people with internet access in Saudi Arabia is actively tweeting every month. And Saudi tweets alone account for nearly half of all Arabic content on Twitter, despite Saudi population being only 10% of Arabic speakers.
Who, in turn, in social terms, is occupying that public space most? What are the kind of groups involved?
There are mainly two big camps, largely a camp of conservatives, social conservatives, and social liberals. But overall, Saudi society is rather conservative and religious, but they just disagree on the extent of limitations that should be imposed on individual freedoms, for example, or on the economy, or on women working. So these are the hot issues, as well as foreign policy.
Do they engage with each other, or are they basically talking to themselves?
They do spar quite often. Usually you see it in replies to news items, something new happening, and the pace has been quite rapid. So just in the space of a few months, the expectation went from King Salman being largely conservative to unprecedented reform, really, and to the meteoric rise of his son, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. And this really leads the conversation, sets the pace for it. So curbing the powers of religious police, giving women the right to drive, arresting popular conservative clerics, the crackdown on Qatar, the belligerent tone against Iran, the Saudization of jobs. So they're all hot issues which immediately provoke a huge reaction on Twitter.
I take it by the Saudization of jobs, you mean that the jobs that used to go to foreign workers are increasingly being reserved for Saudis?
Yes, it's all part of Mohammed bin Salman's Vision 2030, which is preparing Saudi Arabia for a post-oil economy. And they have been cracking down on foreign workers quite effectively, really. Almost 100,000 people arrested or penalized in the past 2 weeks, and providing more jobs for the Saudis in the private sector rather than the public sector, where the government would have to pay for them.
What, say, moves the liberal camp most?
So, first of all, you have to envision these young Saudis who are well-traveled, tech-savvy, exposed to the outside world. They are also exposed to countries which are nearby, which are very similar to Saudi Arabia, such as the UAE or Bahrain. There are also conservative Gulf countries, but they have large expat communities, a thriving private sector, glittering skyscrapers, and access to entertainment. These are the main gains that more liberal Saudis are trying to achieve, as well as the right to drive and to work for women.
And what about, therefore, the other side, the more religiously conservative and Islamist forces? What's getting them going?
There is a very powerful official religious establishment in Saudi Arabia, which has seen its powers curbed. And there are also very popular clerics, very outspoken, quite conservative, who have their own charities, who have their own TV channels. And by putting limits on them, the Crown Prince risks upsetting these audiences, but also he risks upsetting the traditional people who really support the Saudi crown, but view religious conservatism as a way to safeguard their society and its prosperity, and they fear God's punishment, basically, for having all these reforms.
How do you mean God's punishment?
So, for example, there is a user who tweeted that a nation that dances and sings, exposes its sins, calls for decadence, will never be victorious in its endeavors. It will never be prosperous. They really do fear God's wrath for this.
What are the terms in which they discuss the conservatives, the crown prince himself? I mean, given that I imagine that there's a kind of conflict between the deference to the Saudi royal family and the way they feel about what he's doing.
There is a movement of conservative, politicized religious people who are definitely very upset with the crown prince personally. They attack him personally. They point to his relationship to Trump, and these are very politicized, and they attack him frontally. You have the more Salafist, conservative, socially conservative, who comment on the issues themselves. So they would support him on, let's say, a more assertive tone against Iran, against Hezbollah, but they would not support him on women driving, for example. They really think it's forbidden.
Those people who criticise him, in what terms do they do it? I mean, are they really very strident or are they careful?
They are careful. Of course, they are careful if they are based inside Saudi Arabia. There have been arrests of people for tweets, etc. The authorities shut down one of the conservative channels earlier this year, and they had a very popular reality TV show, which is basically a group of young Saudi men who stay and they compete on things such as charity, and they're constantly being filmed, and religious chanting and other religious knowledge and these metrics. So this got shut down, and yes, it prompted the conversation. People didn't really understand. They thought this was quite moderate in nature.
How do the liberals talk about the crown prince?
Many are fans. Many changed their profile pictures to his picture. Many are also seeing it for, especially the older generation who knew Saudi Arabia before it took its ultra-conservative turn in the 70s, are just seeing this as a return to normality. Many young people are really enthused by Mohammed bin Salman's age, but also by his character and the way he has a more assertive foreign policy. He makes bold statements, and he really symbolizes an emergent Saudi nationalism. Strangely, one of the points that unite both conservatives and more progressive people in Saudi society is this aggressive tone against Saudi Arabia's regional rivals such as Iran and Hezbollah. A few days ago, there was even a debate between Saudis and Palestinians online over the thaw between Saudi and Israel. And a popular hashtag was, Riyadh is more important than Jerusalem. This is really new to Saudi society, where religion and country were one, and now we see clearly the nationalist aspect taking the lead in society.
Thank you, Mohammed El-Assar. I'm joined in the briefing room by two keen watchers of the kingdom, Rasha Kandil, presenter of BBC Arabic Newsnight, and from Istanbul by Safa Al-Ahmed, an award-winning Saudi Arabian journalist. Safa Al-Ahmed, if I can ask you first, how did the crown prince actually come to power?
Well, most of how people come to power in Saudi Arabia are not public, are not transparent. We just wake up one day with a royal decree announcing somebody being removed, somebody being put in place. So your guess is as good as mine, would be my answer.
Okay, but what can we, judging from what we know from history, what are these sort of things which tend to move people in and out of position?
Well, so there's a royal committee of hand-picked royal members that supposedly come together and make these decisions. It's a lot of official announcements with no real justifications because they don't need to. I mean, it is a monarchy.
Rasha Kandil, you're nodding vigorously there, so you obviously agree that it is actually as opaque as Safa is saying. But from what you can judge of the Crown Prince where he is now, how powerful do you think he is with regard to the other forces in Saudi Arabia, such as the clerics who we've heard about?
He is the sole decision maker now, despite of the stamp or the signature of his own father on all his decisions. But everybody knows that it's Mohammed bin Salman's ultimate power at the moment.
Safa Ahmed, you grew up in Saudi Arabia, and that's a society which apparently the Crown Prince wants to change significantly. What's it like to grow up in a place like that? And how big do you feel from that experience of the changes that he's talking about?
Mm. Well, I mean, going back to what you're talking about with the clerics, I think the religious establishment and especially the religious police played a huge role in my life.
So how would you experience that? I mean, it's one of these things that's very difficult to comprehend from a British perspective. How is your life actually impacted by that?
Well, the religious police had the ultimate power to arrest you, for example, if they didn't like how you were dressed, or they suspected that the man that you're with having dinner wasn't your husband or wasn't your brother, or wasn't your legal guardian. And they walked around, for example, in the malls with two policemen following them. And so that was not a very subtle symbol how the religious establishment had the power of the state behind them.
So do you mean that if you were, say, sitting in a restaurant, you might see somebody peering through the window at you trying to work out who you were with?
Yes, they have the absolute power to come in and question you and ask you to prove the relationship between you and the male person that you're with.
And you were aware of that when you were growing up?
Well, of course. I mean, everybody was aware of that. It was not very subtle. And even like we were out shopping one day and I had a religious policeman follow me and I had to like run into a taxi and get out to avoid being arrested by him simply because he didn't like the way I was dressed. Another time when I had open toe shoes and I had nail polish on and he basically with the police came to me, stopped me and said, you need to leave the mall. And those are like the nice examples. We have had cases where the religious police went on a car chase after young men and they had a car accident and they died. And that was a famous case that was actually taken to court. And so it was not a subtle power that they had.
So did you feel as if you were the casualty of a contract between the clergy and the politicians?
I mean, obviously, because it is such a toxic thing to mix religion with power. And it is really, really hard to be critical of a government when that mix is there, because then it's hard to disengage from what is your religious duty as a good Muslim and what is your duty as a citizen. And when those things are not clear, then it becomes really, really problematic to have political reform. And so all of that makes the question of reform in the country really complicated. So, yes, it's all great, and the changes now with the possibility of women driving, and that's another question of, like, what is the religious establishment going to do when the woman actually, in a few months, be able to drive in Saudi Arabia? Will that be a peaceful process? Will there be people who would be violent against these women because they're not okay with this? I mean, because for decades now, we've grown up with this idea that driving for women is haram. And then you wake up one day and suddenly the government is saying, oh, no problem. Now women can drive. So to me, yes, these changes that are happening this year are positive because we've been fighting for this for so long. But then the problem is the lack of transparency in this process means that everything can be taken back at any moment.
So, Rashid Kandil, these changes are obviously, in Saudi terms, big. What do you think the Crown Prince's motivations are? And why is he doing this and why is he doing it now?
So there are two stories, versions of the story, if you like. One of them is Mohammed bin Salman is a real reformist. He's really young and he has the support of young people to a huge extent. But the other version of this story is that it is actually a message to the West. It's a message to the United States. He addressed the United States directly, saying that without the cultural influence or impact of the United States over Saudi Arabia, we would end up being like North Koreans. And this shows you that there are two huge parallel lines to answer this question. So if it is a real wave of reform inside the kingdom, why is the human rights record going worse under Mohammed bin Salman, according to the international prominent human rights groups like Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International? It's actually getting worse. The executions of people, including youth or children under 17, is still going on worse than before. And even the vision, the 2030 vision, the base of all the economic reform, puts everything on hold until sometime, including women driving cars.
Safa, what do you understand of his intentions for the Saudi economy?
I think there are mixed signals. There's a lot of optimistic outlooks about what Vision 2030 can and should do for the country. But one of the first interviews that Mohammed bin Salman did give was to Al Arabiya, which is a Saudi-owned channel. And he did this interview, and he was saying things like, by 2020, the people of Saudi Arabia will be able to live without oil. I mean, anyone can tell you that is impossible. And if you read the plan itself for 2030, there are a lot of skeptics and critics of these plans. The problem is, if we're going to talk about youth and how they feel about Mohammed bin Salman, I think that's mixed as well, because the youth have necessarily trying to be optimistic about where the country is going. But the realities are 40% of the youth in Saudi Arabia are unemployed.
He seems to be fighting on all kinds of fronts simultaneously. The clerics, the reliance upon oil, there's the international situation and the battle with Iran. That's an awful lot for one guy, even if he's got a lot of power to take on, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, and this is part of the problem, I think, because some of these fronts were deliberate by him, like Qatar, like Yemen. Those were not things that were pushed upon him. These are fronts that he had deliberately opened himself. And I'll give you an example of a domestic economic situation that I think freaked a lot of people out. Last year, there was a sudden decree that there will be a decrease of about 20% of people's salaries, which are the benefits that were installed during King Abdullah's time. Everybody woke up one day and that was gone. And that was massive impact on people's lives, like direct impact in people's salaries, if you cut 20% of people's salaries. And it did not go down well at all. 9 months later, all of a sudden, again, they wake up with another decree saying that they are reinstating the 20% that they had initially had cut off, and that it will be retroactive. And so to me, I think for people who are serious about looking at these changes, these kind of things seem haphazard, scary, and then you never know. Like, if I was a businessman in Saudi Arabia, I'd be very, very worried.
Rasha, what do you think the biggest risks to the Crown Prince are?
Exactly what you just said now. I believe, as an observer of the geopolitics going in the Middle East day in, day out, I think it's the too many fronts that Mohammed bin Salman is opening upon himself. The wars that he's involved in, that he commissioned, basically, either direct wars like the one in Yemen or proxy wars, as it's claimed in Syria and other areas. So there are a lot of fronts facing Iran, facing Hezbollah, facing Houthis, being involved in so much at
Houthis
the same time.
Houthis are the insurgents,
yes,
in Yemen.
They are in the insurgents in Yemen, yes, that Mohammed bin Salman is accusing of collaborating with Iran and Hezbollah recently. So it's the too many fronts internally and outside that Mohammed bin Salman is opening at the same time.
The BBC's Frank Gardner said this week that the Crown Prince will either be the saviour of his country or he'll take a blowtorch to it, metaphorically loosening the glue which holds the society together. I'm going to ask you both, really, to push ahead and look ahead. Safa, which do you think it is?
I'll go with the Chinese proverb, and it's too soon to tell.
Really? Really too soon? You really think it could go either way?
I mean, I am pessimistic about what's going on simply because of the lack of transparency. And so the question is this the perfect storm for Saudi Arabia or not?
Rasha Kandil, is it or isn't it?
I would say the same. I would say we need to wait and see. But the marks that we can see on the way to this vision of Mohammed bin Salman makes me a little bit more pessimistic, as Safa is, actually, because of the not only because of the lack of transparency, but because there is an open war now in Yemen, for example, one of the, if not the worst catastrophe of the time. This makes me a bit more worried about two things: the international and national front that Mohammed bin Salman is opening so many battles upon, and the other thing is the human rights record of Saudi Arabia.
Okay, to summarise on that, I entered this programme feeling rather, I suppose, optimistic about what the Crown Prince was up to, but having listened to my guests, I'm now feeling slightly more pessimistic and very much a feeling of hold on to your hats, because it's going to be a very bumpy ride. My thanks to Nicholas Pelham, Mohammed Al-Assar, Rasha Kandil and Safa Al-Ahmed. Until next Thursday, good night. The Briefing Room was presented by me, David Aronovich, and produced by China Collins. Please let us know what you think about this programme or the entire series. You can do that by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. We look forward to reading your comments.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.